This is the 50th Anniversary History Conference in Nashville, Tennessee, October 3rd to the 5th, 2003. The recordings from this conference belong to the public domain. The next speaker is Sylvia. Sylvia comes from San Francisco, California, and I want to thank her for coming. She arrived on Thursday and spoke at our women's meeting, a meeting that usually is large. I think if we have 10 people, we had 68 Thursday night.
It was amazing.
It was a really exciting meeting. And today interviewing Sylvia is Trish B. to my right, and I'm Melissa C.
So, this is so exciting. I'm glad to be doing this. You are reputed to have more clean time than any woman in the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. Is that right?
That's my understanding. That's repeated.
Wow.
And I put it out there, so if anyone else had more, and I don't mean just like reformed, I mean with the steps and with a fellowship, because I'm sure there probably are those that just stopped and were able to stop, but that's not transmittable. And so that's what I'm interested in, so is the thing that can be transmitted to another suffering addict.
And you have 41 years?
Yes.
I was curious, what do you do about having a sponsor? Do you have a sponsor?
I do. I had one in the beginning, and like I think, who was it? Yes, one of the other members, Mary Jane, and Jean had a male sponsor, which, as he said, and I didn't know the difference, that supposedly that wasn't supposed to happen, and we might touch on that a little bit with the 13th step afterwards, but I was very serious when I came here, and being of what is deemed of color, Mexican-American, there were not, number one, not that many women, and especially not that many women of color, and this is in hindsight, because at the time I was just desperate, and having no idea of this being a social place to come to look for a boyfriend, get into dances and all that kind of stuff, I was really at the gates of insanity and death. And so naturally the majority of speakers and members were men. And it was with a kind of fear and trembling to hear them, because to separate from my own ideas about men and what they wanted, I had a lot of fear, because I'd had a lot of bad experiences. I just listened for a long time. Well, 6 months was a long time for me. And then I finally heard a man really speak of the steps. And I thought, that's something that you do. It isn't, because at first, without having the capacity to ask for help, which is very difficult for us to ask for help, somehow I had that warped idea that I'm supposed to know it already, and if I listen real hard, I'll be able to get it. And I couldn't. It was just too mind-boggling to me. So that when I really heard, oh, there's a structure, it isn't just coming here and just listening and grabbing this and grabbing that, because I would leave and I'd be out in the parking lot, and it would be like the joy and the hope would be going the minute I would be by myself. And that I couldn't, how do you stop that? How do you stop that desperation and that hopelessness? I was just in a meeting, but I can't keep the group consciousness in my thought. I can't grab it and take it with me and have me be okay till the next meeting, of which there weren't that many. So anyway, with all that gibbering around, I thought, oh yes, sponsorship, right. So, it's very important, and it's become even more important to me later, but I have, well, I won't get into that now, I have a different idea about, I'm not convinced that workshops about it and things like that, because to me, that's like a real deep relationship that you have, even really, probably even more meaningful in kind of a different way, but yet meaningful as marriage, because it's a relationship that has to do with a spiritual life, with honesty, with truth in things that would not be necessarily conducive or able to be communicated with a mate. Simply, not that there's any secrets, but simply that once you've said something, it's like the other person could keep thinking about it, even get like a visual picture of something, you know, like sometimes it I guess it's just between the line between brutal frankness and honesty. And to have a no conflict of interest with a sponsor is very important so that you can be totally honest. In the beginning, that's really important because so many things that we think are so horrendous and that I'll take this to the grave with me or whatever, once we really write it out and then express it, it's gone. It's gone really to its native nothingness. It was just our fear and our own dishonesty of not being able to be honest. So in a way, with a sponsor, you get to be honest about your dishonesty and then just realize, oh boy, you know, now it's like a different foundation that you get set on, and things aren't like, I can't say this or I can't say that, whatever, with that sponsor. But now I do feel it's important that women with women and men with men, just because of what I've seen, that even now in the 21st century that we have, 2003, it hasn't changed much with since the beginning of time, with women being oppressed, not just going with the man. Mm-hmm. Some less than others, but I have really been surprised at how lonely women can be without a man, even in this day and age of such freedom and all that kind of stuff. And I do believe that that's something that's innate, that we may just come here with, and that it's to be worked through, but not in a way, the way like kind of feminism did it, and all they to me seem to do is just to act like men now. I can do what the man does, and it still ended up being sad and not fulfilling. So anyway, with sponsorship, men with men and women with women, and of course the basis being the steps and not just talking, the talking after the steps, you know, once you do them and then whatever communication that you have there. But to me, I found that just talking about problems is like rehearsing them. Because when you get through, you don't really have the feeling of it being removed by this power, because that's what we have to do with the steps of facing them, being rid of them, expressing them on paper. And in the basic text, I haven't read all the books. That's another thing, too. It just seems like every time I turn around, they're publishing another book or doing another book, and I'm just, enough already, you know. But the basic text has got a wonderful, wonderful, the chapter is very good on the 10th step, which would seem like, well, that's way up there, but to me, continued. And I had to look up the word continued, and it says remain doing what you did before. So what I did before was the fourth step, and then the fifth step, so that it's just like, once you do the first one, the rest just follow. And then it's just 4 through 9 for 10, 11, and then 12. And that's what is so beautiful to me about the steps, which is the program that can keep a fellowship of men and women from the infights or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, have you seen a change since the time that you came into now in the importance of the steps or the practical application of the steps?
Yes, I have. At first, because it's new, and I think just the flush of, oh, there's people like me, or whatever, that it was very much just on friendship and being together in groups and stuff. This is how I saw it. And then when the flush of it would go, there would be natural resentments about this or that when you get real close and don't really have a foundation. And then what would happen is, it was like it was said in the meeting just before, you don't talk to that person anymore, and then little clicks start and all that kind of stuff. And maybe that's just a natural process of what happens. But I am convinced if the process right from the beginning can stay with the foundation of the steps, there would be less and less of that, because they would be truer and more in unity with the purpose when you do whatever it is. And you may not want to be doing outside things with people inside. It's not a requirement, because it's to take these steps in all your affairs out there. And just like somebody said, when they wanted to bring somebody home to stay on their couch and the mate was not a member or an addict, it was like a threat to them in their house. So we have to just kind of be alert. Be alert to other people around us. In the beginning, it was like, this is what I have to do and I want to do, and I did it. I had two children. One of them wasn't given to me for a while after I came home from being in prison. And I look back on it, and there were mistakes that I made that had them feel that I cared more about the addict that I was bringing in on the couch. And it was so, because I didn't yet know how to even communicate with my own. So it's like I had to start from the outside to bring it in to the inside. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to have had enough time with both of my daughters. One of them accepted me and had a better understanding of what I was doing and didn't feel so cut off. And the other one, it never happened. She just totally cut me out of her life. And that took the steps to get me through that too, because it just made more ideas for myself that I should have done this, I could have done that, should have, would have, could have, all that kind of stuff. But that was in the past. I don't feel that way. I felt I gave her half a life of nothing and the other half to choose from, with really wanting to be a mother. And it was her choice not to take that.
Sylvia, I'd like to know if you would share with us, please. You've told us a little bit about how meetings were brought to you when you were incarcerated.
Yes.
Upon your release, you mm-hmm. sought meetings mm-hmm. out in the Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about how long your recovery was in Los Angeles, and then you're moving up to the San Francisco area.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how long were you in L.A.?
4 years.
Okay, tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about that, and then what took you up
okay.
north.
All right. I, as I say, the 12 steps found me in jail, and I didn't realize what an impact they were going to have on my life, because I just thought my only problem was to get out of here. And but I'm very grateful for the sweet women that did show up, and it was with the first fellowship of these steps, and those women that came, because NA was not old enough or foundational enough to have to be able to go into institutions at that time.
What about
this
what
was 1960.
1960.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't they weren't there yet. They weren't able to have a hospital institution with permission to go into the jails and institutions yet. So that gave me the first taste of it, even though I didn't realize how deeply that had hit me inside. But I never forgot it. But it wasn't something that when I finally did get released, I thought about doing. It wasn't there. My thing was to get my children, get them back, and make up to them for all of this time that I was not, the lights were on and nobody was home. But so it took about 30 days of my being out in very frightening freedom. I thought, when I get out, that's all I need. And when I got it, it was devastating to me because I didn't know how to live. I didn't know what I was going to do. And the obsession was there because what do you do when you have such self-centered fear? What did you learn to do? Which was to get loaded, to take it away. And I knew I wasn't going to do that. It was just like something deep inside of me that had taken so much from me. But with just an obsession not to take drugs is not enough, because eventually that will wear off. And the obsession for me to not take drugs left a vacuum. What goes in there now? What is going to keep me from doing that? Because I had all different kinds of ideas based on money. Okay, I'll find the connection. And I even did. I called the connection and got on consignment some heroin to sell. Because, okay, if I sell it, then I'll have money. And it was so interesting because I thought, that's the answer. That's all I knew. So when I got in touch with him, he came, he put it in my hand, and I just started shaking. It was almost like a seizure of some kind, and I just dropped it and ran, which was, you just don't do something like that because you look crazy in front of the person, but I knew, this is it, I can't do this. And I just ran away, just left it, 2 ounces of heroin, just left it and ran, and I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? I'm going crazy, all this stuff. And in the midst of all of that, I remembered the county jail and the women, and they'd given me the little white pamphlet of Narcotics Anonymous. And I got to it. Now, what happened? Oh, what happened just a little bit before that, before the real going to the meetings, is that in the midst of all that confusion, I needed to see my father, who was a batterer. He had battered me because he had been battered. You cannot transmit what you don't have. But somehow I had such compassion for him. And I found him in his little apartment where my mother had divorced him and left. And the number one thing was so interesting to me is that he looked so little. He always like was so powerful and so strong, and I had such fear of him. And there he was, just brokenhearted by himself. And I had such compassion, and I never had that for him because he just was, he was such a, like somebody just to fear so much. And I saw him, and I had this feeling, and he offered me a can of Olympia beer and a straight shot of whiskey. Now, I was just doing this all with nothing. And I didn't think anything about it. I just took it, drank it, and got immediate relief from all of this tension that I was having. And I thought, which was the obsession not to have any heroin. And I thought, oh my God, this is what I'll do. I'll drink and not have to have those feelings. That lasted about 30 days because I went very, very fast. As they say, because I drank a lot before I got into heroin. And to get to that point was so quick and so dramatic for me, really. That's when I thought about those little ladies. And I picked up the phone, and Jimmy answered. And he was very much with women and men with men. And so it had taken me 3 days of courage to phone Hollywood 33124. I'll never forget that number.
Wow.
And to call and to get the courage to call. And then when he answered, you know, just tell him, I think I need help. I just got out of jail. It's okay. Here's a phone number. Here's a woman. You call her, and I think, oh, my God. I hung up. I said, how can I have that courage to phone another person? It took everything I could do to phone here, but I did. I did. And I think to this day it was Penny. I'm not sure. She was the one that they talked about, the nurse, pharmaceutical addict. She was not a street dope fiend or anything.
Right.
And I think she came with, I can't remember his name, but it was a Cadillac to pick me up. And all of this stuff, I couldn't believe all this. How can this be happening? We went to the meeting. It was small. But there was like this feeling of being safe somehow. There was just this feeling of safety, even as small as it was, because of all of the things that I'd done that I could never do before. Pick up the phone and call and, you know, make appointments and follow through and call and be there when they pick you up. So, and then the thing with that, to keep going to those two meetings and then have the realization that everybody there wasn't absolutely clean.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize that. And how I got to realize it one day is that I'd just gone to the end of my rope of just having the fellowship be it. There were steps, there's work to be done that you have to do to remain here. Otherwise, it's like what this thing was talking about, 50 come, 49 go. So anyway, with that, I was sharing in this small meeting, and I was at the point of tears, which I never cried after as a child to get hit so much. I just thought nobody's ever going to make me cry again, and I went through a lot of stuff, and it didn't happen. It was like I just completely shut off all emotions. I couldn't. I was getting to the point here that, and I just broke down and cried one day of just not knowing. What do you do? How am I going to stay here? And this little one-armed dope fiend sidled up to me, and he said, Sylvia, you do this so hard. You know, like, ease up. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? He said, just take a little turpentine, you know, to take the edge off.
What is that?
It's like a real deep, it's a strong... it's got a great percentage of alcohol and codeine, and it's a cough syrup that you used to could get over through a prescription in a drugstore. It was just heavy. You're supposed to take a teaspoon of this cough syrup. But when you have it, it's like a little bottle like that that you can just take, but it's a lot of codeine in it mixed in with alcohol. And it would take the edge. And in those days, I guess as long as you didn't shoot any heroin,
You weren't using.
Right. And there was it around, and then pills or whatever. But that frightened me, because to me, I was so literal when that little pamphlet said, those who keep coming to meetings regularly stay clean. I thought it wasn't true, because they kept coming to meetings. But so I knew even more so. It wasn't a judgment against them. It was there's more that you have to do than just keep coming to these meetings, and I don't know what it is. And it was frightening to me. So I had to go to the other fellowship, fearfully. I did, because I didn't trust this anymore.
And was this around, when did you then make the shift to go back, or go up to San Francisco?
Okay, that was like, I was 4 years
and when
clean
you,
then.
When you did that, listening, like Jimmy Kay was working really hard
right.
to move the program forward, and then Terry was in New York, and he was really trying to inundate New York. Did you go with the mindset of, I'm really going to push NA forward, or did you just go thinking, you know, I'm going to start a meeting?
No, it was, Actually, it was always to have this be available, but the main thing, it was self-centered, but not to do any, not to lessen Narcotics Anonymous. It was just a way to be able to get there, because my then husband was in San Quentin, so that was closer in that area. But it really wasn't to run away, because I kept going. I went to both fellowships there. It wasn't like I just threw them out. In fact, I went with more fervor of the steps, even in Narcotics Anonymous, so that people that thought that you could, you know, do this or that, or that alcohol wasn't that bad, or this or that, they really got the realization, and that's why it did get in the pamphlet that even alcohol, that it was a program of abstinence from everything.
Was it everything. Written then, alcohol is a drug?
Yes, it was in there, and it was that emphasis, just because of this other thing of thinking that as long as you don't do that, this is okay if you don't overdo it, some kind of like controlling of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Well, can we kind of, mm-hmm. I guess you mentioned that at that point, if you were a heroin addict, then, you know, heroin was the drug.
Yes.
And as you have been in recovery and different drugs have become mm-hmm. in vogue for different periods of time, how have you, has that changed sort of the program, the sentiment of the
Yes,
program, the
I believe it has. I believe it has. And it, because of just the thing that happens with people and classifications, it's like, there had to then, well, this person doesn't identify with that one because they're, you know, either taking a crack or crystal or this or that.
The substance
yes.
can change the program.
Yes, yes. If you're not really founded in the steps and you're still into that thing that addicts have, because so many go to prison, you have to get your group in prison. You have to, whether it's the Mexicans here or the blacks there or the Aryans here, all that. It's like a brain set. And you can't get rid of it, really, once you get out here without the steps and having this completely psychic change that has to happen as the result of the steps. And so I had to just kind of take it just step by step and just realize that it'll change if they stay here long enough to get out of that kind of mindset, because I found for me that also the other thing, that addicts are very material minded. It's like, even then it was like a show of success was the job you had, the car you drove. It almost like becomes like society judges you. It's like we could take that on too, but we really can't, because down deep inside, we really do need a spiritual way of living where you can't see those things. Those things are, you have to trust and have faith in the things that you can't see. And that only comes from the steps. But to have the patience and tolerance to just let it be as it is, and that's why I keep telling everybody, just remain. Just continue. Don't get disunified. Don't get, you know, this group or that group or whatever. It's a killer. Mm-hmm. It's a killer.
So you think that the substances, as they've changed over the years, as different things have
changed the fellowship.
Of all things
yes.
that they have.
And to change it so, if it has to get changed so badly that it just has to get so bad to get better, so be it. And I feel that that's where we're at, like peeking in at that point. I think it's had all the divisiveness that it needs to. The last one is this thing, you know, about individuals that were, you know, like we've been hearing, that,
uh-huh.
that he was done wrong, this, and it, to just let it be and just keep going forward with this vision for Narcotics Anonymous mm-hmm. as a whole, for what are we going to be here. 'Cause it plays into new people coming in that have come in with nothing but resentments about whatever it is, whether it was the police or their parents or whatever, then they're coming here and hearing the same kind of stuff, and then you just think, wait a minute, it's supposed to be, it has to be different at some point, but just to be able to be patient, not throw the baby out with the bathwater, and just remain and continue to do your steps, your service work, whatever it has to be, and just be like a mediator, if it has to be with it.
And what do you think about the role of the traditions in that? Because I know that when I've been listening to people talk about Jimmy Kay, that he was very into the traditions and he knew them very, very well. And, you know, as we're seeing kind of more division within the fellowship, do you think there's more or less of an awareness of the traditions, and what's your experience with the traditions? I don't know how to phrase that.
I think, and yeah, no, you phrase it very well. I think as a whole, even in both fellowships, the one before and after, that the traditions have been like kind of poo-pooed in a way because they've not been carried forth with the respect that they needed. And that's neither here nor there. I mean, it's like movie stars getting into AA, getting drunk or whatever, and it's just like getting businesses and having it be based on the 12-step and whatever way, but all coming down to your pocketbook, you know, like it's going. So that it's like kind of shaved because there is no tradition police that could come and say, you know, you're doing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
How you find out you've broken a tradition is when you fail, because it's not going to keep going. It cannot. Because of the spiritual power and strength that is it that has you, gives you the freedom to make all these mistakes and realize it and stop, or keep going to the bitter end and lose everything. And when you really think about it, all of those that started out like that failed in some way or another. And when they looked the other way with the traditions, It was not good. I mean, the people, it looked like they were really sailing along for a while, then the program, then they usually get very sick and die. The woman that started the first house in Northern California, in San Jose, just, to me...
Beth, was that her name?
Mm-hmm. Had all the good intentions and stuff, but there was still that need there to do that. And like, okay, now I can do this, but I can get this done for all these people. It was not a good thing. And I don't think she passed away very happily. I think she even ended up back in prison, if I'm not mistaken. But all of those things are just lessons to see that we really don't need anybody confronting us, unless it's at a, you know, at a group level and in a way that's with a group conscience. But to try to tell people this is not the right way to go when there is some selfish or self-centered reason, it's not going to work. And all you can do is have them be just a good example of what you don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And not be resentful. Just try as best not to have those things happen in the fellowship, and look and see what started this. Where did this start? Don't want to do. Let's not do that again.
Right. Mm-hmm. Can I ask a real quick question while we're on the step?
Yes.
We have this great step working guide now, which takes you through, and it's so deep and explorative. How did you do the steps when you first got here? That was
when I heard this man sharing for the first time about him doing the fourth step, and I was just on the first three steps there, which to me now I have a real realization that they're mental. There's no physical stuff to it. It's the first personal action you get is the fourth step, to get the paper and pen and write it down. And in those days they were the columns. That's the way they were in the big book. But I thought, oh my God, that's what it is. That's what you have to do. That's the next thing. Was I not hearing that before? No. You don't hear till you hear. You don't see till you see. Here was this little man had a down like on the Bowery in on Main Street in downtown Los Angeles, had a little peep show. The men put the quarter in and see these little girls, you know, not little girls, but women dancing around. That was like the preface to all this porn that goes on now. That's what his, that was his little job. That was his little concession that he had. But he was just so honest, and for the first time in my life, I went up to him and I said, what are you talking about with the steps? And he just got the book, opened it up, and he says, go home and do this. And I had something to do. Now, I would not recommend and not have to anyone since then. I believe that the steps, you hear it, hear somebody talking about it, and you want how they did it, not what they have. When it says, if you want what we have is the group. Nobody should want what I have, because I don't want what I have. But it's us together. It's us together. And that's what he told me to do. And I went home very frightened, but I did it, just like it was there. And it wasn't a big smash kind of feeling, but I had done it. I had followed directions. I had done that. Now, I didn't know what to do with it afterwards, because I didn't see him anymore. Yeah. So then another man... had this group, and I identified with him, and our background was none at all back. He was an English professor, a teacher. Now he's got the head of the in AA, the Pacific group, that's got, you know, meetings all over internationally and all over the world. The biggest meeting in Los Angeles on Wednesday is that meeting. But that's not when I knew him. I knew him, he didn't have any front teeth, and he took him 10 years to get a year, slept out in the parking lot in his old beat up car. But I was able to read my inventory to him and felt that I was doing the steps. Then there was a woman that came into my experience, and I was able to, but not like I do it now, which is daily. And then it was like a yearly, annual kind of thing. But I always was with the steps, because I couldn't trust myself, and my experience with people and friends was not good. And I know it's got to be something more than that. Then I can have friends and be able to, because I'm not dependent on them and they're not dependent on me in that way that is needy, that will bring up resentments, that can put people on pedestals and then knock them down. We need to just get rid of that and just have this power so that we can be in unity together and be able to communicate when we have differences in any way. But sponsorship is very important, but not personal, because it's a personality. It really, hopefully the thing that can be attractive is what they do with the steps, because that's what can be passed on. That's what can be transmitted for each person to get their own unique experience with this. Because you can't get anybody else's experience. It's like a gate to get your own, because it's not the end all. It just keeps growing and growing and growing as you continue to grow in NA in the steps, spiritually.
You know, I was just thinking of something as I was listening to you share. I wrote up the little announcements describing the women's meeting that you and the other four ladies were invited to, and the Monday announcement for our home group, that's lunch bunch. And there's a guy sitting next to me, Chuck, and he's making a scowl on his face saying, I don't like that. And he has a problem with Narcotics Anonymous groups that are gender specific, women's meetings, with gay and lesbian meetings that call themselves Narcotics Anonymous. And he says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. And I wonder if you have any feelings on that. If they're special interest Narcotics Anonymous groups, do you feel like that breaks any tradition?
No, I don't. I think for me, special interest in the proven good way is to have, like, whether it's Latinos or blacks or gays or lesbians who feel even in the 12-step not a part of, to have a special interest for that meeting, like say their home group, whatever, and be able to take what they get from there, a feeling of belonging to the program, not to live up to people's approval in any way, because obviously they haven't been able to do that because we're, you know, out in left field. We can't, and we don't. But to come here and be in a group that has no opinion on your gender or whatever, so that if we start getting it, it's like we're like the ones that had us out, that didn't want anything to do with drug addicts, period, not having any difference with them what their gender was. They just didn't like those people. They were bad. So we turn around and do the same thing with these people. But the point is, when they come to a special interest, the point is for them to get that feeling of belonging and then be able to take that out to the regular meetings and feel a part of. And then have it be all one. Not bringing up their own, whether it's nationality or race or gender, just be in unity at one. To learn that in their special interest group and then go out and be able to become a part of it. Not keep taking that separateness that they feel into it, and that's what I think makes people get resentful. But that's their problem. It was like, it's his problem, whatever it is. But on the whole, I am for special interest groups that can get that feeling of belonging and take it on into the greater picture of the group.
You probably, being in the San Francisco area, you probably see a lot of that.
Yes, yes, yes. And some of it I don't like, because there, in some, especially in the gender things, that becomes as important as their alcoholism. And to me, I don't feel that. But I don't argue with it, but I can see that it can take you off the beaten path if you get away from what unites us here. And it is not what your gender is or what your sexual preference is. I think too much can be put onto that. We're alcoholics, addicts. And then that's the first thing. And if you can really know that, then the other things become less important at the group level.
Well, and I never understand why people get so bent out of shape about special interest things anyway, because it's not that they couldn't come. It's just a matter of respect.
Yes.
You know, like, I respect that these women want to have a group where they can talk about things that are important and relevant. It's not that somebody's going to say, oh, you're a man.
Yes.
Get out of here.
I know it.
But it's just an environment where we can feel safe, I think.
Right, but I never understand
right.
why people get upset.
We've just been given
I know, it's 45 minutes.
To watch.
Yes.
I think just on a final note, because I felt it was important because of Sylvia's history. She did go up to San Francisco, I think, at a time. Were there any meetings in San Francisco when you went up there?
No.
Just let's wrap it up on that, because that's really unique
okay.
to you, and I think our listeners would want to hear about
right.
that, because you were a pioneer.
Yes. Went up there, and there were no meetings. Found a meeting place at 1744 University Avenue in Berkeley. And went there, and I'd had to take my two girls. I didn't have meetings that had child care. And they would be out in the little toy room or the rec room of the church. And I just sat there and waited. We'd put advertisements out, and then...
Where would you advertise? How would you do that?
Oh, flyers. Let's see, there was like... actually, in the other fellowship, they had a bulletin board, so we'd do that. And there was... a job also that I'd gone up for, that UC Berkeley wanted to study addicts and wonder how they could stay clean, because they'd never heard of addicts staying clean. And so this woman volunteered me to come up and talk to this professor in sociology. And the best thing I can tell you is that lasted for about a year. And it was called Ad Center, ADD-Center, where they would come and interview us, and even actually taped a meeting at one point, and I told him, you're not going to be able to get anything from this. And so he said, well, we'll see. So they took it, and they all listened, and they came back, and they said, you were right. Whatever you guys are doing, just keep doing it. It's not something that can be pegged down sociologically or whatever, because it has a spiritual basis. So then from that, then I had always tried to have the Narcotics Anonymous meeting apart from that, but that closed up and it was fine, and I was up there and that was it. We paid $300 a month, you know, to have that little center open, to have people, addicts referred there. And some of them that went there went on to Narcotics Anonymous, and there's two or three of them that I know of are still clean today, you know. And it was, and from that, to sit there, they'd come across the bridge, come from San Francisco to Berkeley to come to this meeting, and it proved to be the first and longest meeting. It's still going now in a different building, but it's still going.
What
and
day of the week does it mean?
Tuesday. Tuesday night in Berkeley, and it was called the Candlelight Meeting.
An hour-long meeting?
It was an hour and a half, I believe, because coming from Los Angeles, they were hour-and-a-half meetings. And here in San Francisco, all meetings were an hour. So it was just kind of that kind of thing. But, yeah, it was great, and it grew really, really quickly and good. It was just really, really nice there.
And do you have any idea how many meetings there are
now?
Ooh. In that area?
I probably could easily say just in that area, maybe 100.
Wow. Jeez. How quickly after that first meeting opened?
Did another one?
Yeah.
The other one was in San Francisco at Mason, in the basement of the Congregational Church, and that was probably, it was less than a year, that one. And then another one sprung up, another one in Berkeley, a step study. And then another in San Francisco, and then San Jose got some, and then San Jose would come up to San Francisco to the meetings. And
so you were 4 years clean, so this is putting this back
yes.
66?
66, 67.
And these primarily were also heroin users.
Yes, the majority. There was the beginning there, too, of methamphetamine. I remember this one woman that came in that was just so, I mean, the reaction was so different than heroin, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just, but she was welcome and whatever. She didn't stay, though. But anyway.
That still is prevalent.
It's coming more. Yes, it is. It is. It's becoming even more so now, like a resurgence of it. But anyway.
Sylvia, yes. We could talk to you for 49 hours.
We might not be staying
there. Anyway. I'm so glad. I'm
so
glad it went
the
way. We both of you, all three of us, just
really neat.
Okay. So.
Well.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'm gonna stay for long, and we don't know how to turn the machine off. But we'll just say goodbye for the CD or whatever.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks again.
This was great.
Yes.
Great.